Skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see.
Songwriters like Irving Berlin, George and Ira Gershwin, and Jerome Kern wrote popular songs that achieved a notable artistry, both in lyrics and music. That body of work, at least the best of it, came to be known as the Great American Songbook. But it's a little bit less widely understood that in about 1950, the stream of great songs more or less dried up. All of a sudden, what came over the radio was not Gershwin. It was Come On to My House and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail.
Elvis and rock and roll arrived a few years later, and at that point, the game was truly up. What happened and why? Those are the questions that cultural historian Ben Yagoda looks to answer in his new book, The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song. It's a great pleasure to welcome Ben Yagoda to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the invitation.
What got you thinking about the Great American Song and what happened to it?
This idea of the Great American Songbook, it's a term that only really started being used in the 1970s, but it refers to this body of great songs that really were written, the great majority of them, between about 1925 and 1950. If you look at a Tony Bennett album or Tony Bennett concert today, or some of the aging rockers who put out albums of standards, there's been a tradition since Willie Nelson, Linda Ronstadt, on up to Rod Stewart, you find that the great majority of the songs on these records are from that period. And it was really a wonderful period in American music that I've always been a fan of. And when it came time to looking for a new book project for me, I thought maybe I might write something about it because I loved it so much. When I started looking into it, unfortunately, I realized that there had been a number of very good books written about it already. But in my reading, what I discovered was that, contrary to the popular idea, I think the popular idea is that this period in music was ended by rock and roll, that first there was the Great American Songbook, then rock and roll did away with it. In fact, there was a pretty long gap of close to 10 years from the end of World War II on up through the arrival of rock and roll in 55 and 56 and the person of Elvis and Bill Haley and Little Richard and so on, when everything was really in kind of chaos in popular music. People were bemoaning as late as the late 40s, there aren't good songs being written anymore. There was no rock and roll, but there was this kind of a strange mixture of songs that came over the air. You mentioned a couple of them, these novelty numbers like Come On to My House and Doggy in the Window, but also folk songs, things related to blues, international foreign kind of sounds like the Third Man theme. Lead Belly's Goodnight Irene was a number one hit from the Weavers in the early 50s.
Irene, goodnight.
It just struck me that this was an interesting period of popular music, and I wanted to try to figure out exactly what was going on.
One of the things that you point out in the book, which I find really interesting, is that this idea of the Great American Songbook and our terminology for it and our great respect for it is really relatively new.
You know, another term for the Great American Songbook, which is not an official, you know, book of songs, that people have different ideas of it, but basically a few hundred of these classic songs from the Gershwins, Cole Porter, and others. Another term is the standards. And the idea of there being this body of songs, of these standards, as you say, didn't come into play until after the period was over. You know, it seemed to me in my research and my interviews, what was the case was that just as it was ending, was the period when it was enshrined, which makes a certain amount of sense. But Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra and some other people started making these record albums, the new LP format, in the mid to late 50s that really were composed of this kind of song, these standards. And that was the first time that they were really widely recognized as such. So even as that era was ending, it was being recognized as, it's almost like a, in the classical music repertoire, these songs, compositions that are considered classics are played and interpreted again and again by great musicians and not so great musicians, that was happening to this body of popular songs starting in the late 50s and continuing on till today.
You talk about one song in particular, and it's a fascinating story, I think, about Young at Heart and how that came to be and really helped launch the comeback of Frank Sinatra.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart.
Yeah. Well, it just so happened that I was doing some research in the New York Public Library Theater Collection up at Lincoln Center, and it so happened that there was a lyricist named Carolyn Lee who turned out to be a great, great pack rat, a correspondent, wrote a lot of letters, received a lot of letters, kept everything, kept carbon copies of the letters she wrote. This was back starting in the early 50s on and through the rest of her life, in through the 80s, and all this material was in this collection at Lincoln Center, and I thought that her life and her experiences would be one of the several windows I use in the book to look at what was going on in popular music at the time. And she was trying to break in. She was a receptionist at an advertising firm in the very, very late 40s, and actually a wrong number came in from a music publisher, and she started talking to him and told him that she had a goal of being a songwriter herself. And so she started sending in songs to this guy. From that, it happened that the publisher had been working with a West Coast jazz man named Johnny Richards, who had a tune that needed words, and that was the way the business worked in those days. It was kind of hooking up the composers and the songwriters. He gave Carolyn Lee the tune, and right about that time, she had just visited her father, who was in the hospital from having suffered a heart attack, and she was worried about him, and out of that experience came the lyric, the song that you mentioned, Young at Heart. That found its way to Frank Sinatra, who was at that point just about at the bottom of his career. He, the previous year, had been dropped by Columbia Records just because his songs weren't selling anymore, and picked up by a smaller label, still a major label, Capitol Records, kind of on a gamble. And that was the first single he put out for Capitol Records. It was a great hit and led to his great comeback, one of the greatest comebacks in American music, if not American life. Sinatra's great Capitol Records of the late 50s and early 60s all started with Young at Heart.
To be young at heart, for as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young.
Also enter into this equation about that time, around 1953, Tony Bennett, who was a fan of this music and of these songs, and really brokered a deal that said, okay, I'll record pop hits, but for every one of those, I'm going to do a rags to riches.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care. And though my pocket may be empty, I'd be a millionaire.
Well, I think Rags to Riches would have been considered one of his pop hits. He was also at Columbia Records that had dropped Sinatra, which was the biggest record label, and under the aegis of Mitch Miller, who would later be known as the impresario of Sing Along with Mitch. This was before then, and he was the power broker at Columbia. He decided which artists would be signed, which songs they would sing, and he was the first modern producer, sit in the control room and play with the dials and put in. He was famous for sound effects and overdubbing and things like that. And he really had a sort of golden touch when it came to hits. And he, you know, in unlikely combinations, he hooked up Tony Bennett with Hank Williams. Tony Bennett, an Italian boy from Astoria, Queens, with Hank Williams from Alabama, with his song Cold, Cold Heart.
I try so hard, my dear, to show that you were my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
And made a hit out of it. Rags to Riches was kind of semi-Ersatz operatic aria that came out of Tin Pan Alley. And again, Bennett had a hit with it. And he didn't really respond to this kind of material, but just as you say, he made a deal that he would do the pop songs for Mitch as singles if he would be allowed to make these albums of standards with great jazz musicians. And, you know, of course, Tony Bennett is still doing that today, most recently in his duets with Lady Gaga, which are pretty darn good.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness. And I just, all those things you've always been.
And bringing it to a new audience.
Absolutely, yeah, and the Grammys and everything. It's really pretty amazing.
And that has been going on for the last several decades. And you mentioned this earlier, but you go back to an album that Linda Ronstadt made many, many decades ago with the great Nelson Riddle.
Yeah, Linda Ronstadt is who I was able to talk to for the book, and she had some great insights and perspective. She's a real student of American music, of all different kinds of music, as well as was a great singer. She's now retired. As you say, a lot of people have done these records, and even before she did it, Harry Nilsson did one, Willie Nelson did it, the great Stardust record. But Linda Ronstadt wanted to do it right, so not only did she have the great material, but she picked the greatest arranger of this material, Nelson Riddle. Started working with him not long before his death, made three LPs with him, What's New, Lush Life, and one more. And, you know, she did everything. She dressed on the cover with a vintage gown and really did loving kind of recreations of, or reinterpretations of the songs and of the vintage arrangements, not as museum pieces, you know, trying to make them sound right for that period in the 80s and early 90s when she was doing it, but with a real, real respect for the material and the arrangements.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I'll hope that he turns out to be someone.
How much of this was linked to Broadway?
Broadway was a huge part of this Great American Songbook. And in that golden era, popular songs were really a three-legged stool. And roughly one-third of the best pop songs came out of Broadway. One-third came out of Hollywood. Hollywood musicals and, you know, standalone songs in Hollywood pictures. And one-third came out of that so-called Tin Pan Alley, the music publishing industry in New York City, that where there would be, you know, the Brill Building and other buildings with songwriters and little Warren-like offices trying to pound out hits. One of the things that happened in this period when and things kind of changed was two of the legs fell away. Hollywood stopped making musicals, and I think largely because of the dissipation of the big bands and the big band era, Tin Pan Alley stopped producing, for the most part, really top-notch songs. It was more kind of material and novelty numbers and gimmicky hits. And that really left only Broadway. And in the late 40s to the 50s into the early 60s, Broadway with Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Cole Porter and Kiss Me Kate, Frank Lesser and Guys and Dolls, Richard Adler and Jerry Ross and Pajama Game.
The Pajama Game is the game I'm in, and I'm proud to be in the Pajama Game. I love it.
That was where the bulk of the great songs came out of. Of course, even that changed into the 60s, but that's another story.
Well, it is another story, but it is worth noting that through the 60s and 70s, there were still songwriters and songwriting teams that were putting out songs worthy of the great standards.
Well, I'm not sure I would necessarily agree. I think someone like Stephen Sondheim, was and still is doing great work. But, I think even Broadway itself kind of split in the 60s into the 70s, that there was the sort of popular successes later typified by, Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera that would run for years and years and years, and the out-of-towners would come to see. Then there were the more arty shows, of course, led by Sondheim and many others. And those, were great in their way, but maybe to their credit, they were more about the total package than the individual songs. In an earlier era, like a song like The Lady is a Tramp.
I get too hungry for dinner at 8. I like the theater, but never come late. I never bother with people I hate. That's why The Lady is a Tramp.
A great Rodgers and Hart song would come out of some forgettable musical with a sort of interchangeable plot, boy meets girl, et cetera, et cetera, and the song would be the thing. In the later years, for the best Broadway and musical theater pieces, you can't really take the song away from the whole. I mean, the only hit in Stephen Sondheim's career, I believe, was Send in the Clowns from right. Little Night Music, and that was a fluke. I mean, he was as surprised as anybody, and I think a little alarmed when that became a hit.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns.
He wrote it to fit into that particular piece, not to be a standalone song.
But you do make the point later in the book that the Beatles and Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys and Bob Dylan were coming along, and they were emerging and creating songs with some of the qualities that mark that tradition.
Right, no question. And yeah, the subtitle of my book, The Rebirth of the Great American Song, I feel that when rock and roll hit, it was an explosion. And for 3 or 4 years, in the late 50s, that was really what was going on, led by Elvis.
Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who a heart is true. I don't want no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of.
Then kind of the dust cleared, and those early rock songs were just kind of three chords and the beat, and that was pretty much it. But that played itself out to an extent, and then all of a sudden there was room for the more subtle melodic kind of songs, and that some of the people you mentioned started writing them, and later the singer-songwriters. They weren't really the same type of song as the Great American Songbook. I mean, the biggest change I would point to is that earlier song came out of jazz. And this later song came out of a lot of the music that was on, that was playing in the 50s, the folk, blues, rhythm and blues. So it tended not to be as complex, not a lot of diminished seventh chords and things like that. But in the hands of some of these great writers, and, you know, Joni Mitchell and Otis Redding and Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham, et cetera, those songs have proved to be Carole King, Burt Bacharach, who did write a more complex song. Those songs have proved to be as enduring as the earlier ones. Similarly lasting, but different in feel.
I feel the earth move under my feet.
I have to mention this because he's one of my favorites, but you do mention Stan Freberg in the book, someone who was very early on kind of making fun of the new stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I quoted was he was on to Mitch Miller and his Yellow Rose of Texas and just had a hilarious parody of it.
Yeah! Don't let me startle you. I'm just doing the rebel yell here to kind of kick things off, you know what I mean?
That I am gonna say, nobody else could miss her, not half as much as me. She cried so when I left her, pardon me. That's just a shade loud on the snare drum.
She's the sweetest little rosebud that Texas Avenue. Her eyes are bright as diamonds, they sparkle like the dew.
See, now you covered up, sparkle like the dew. One of the loveliest parts in the whole
Texas is the only girl for me.
Covered up the piccolos there with a Rio Grande, with a Rio, where, what? See, my feeling is that while I love a good snare drum, I feel that volume-wise, it's just a little bit too much what you're doing there, see what I mean? Now you try and hold it down, will you? Appreciate it. Where the Rio Grande, appreciate it. Where the Rio Grande is flowing and starry sky, that's better. She walks along the river on the quiet.
It's great because it but again, and he would do that even with Harry Belafonte and many others of sort of going, because he had that sort of that deep standard voice, and yet he was again making fun of the new stuff.
Yeah, and you know, when the deeper you look into the 1950s, the more you realize that the popular idea of it being a simple time, I mean, there's some truth to it, but there was a lot of great satire. I mean, Stan Freberg, Bob and Ray, a lot of people were very, very aware of what was going on in that mainstream culture and skewered it brilliantly.
One of my favorite lines from Stan Freberg is that songs like that were never released, they escaped. And I thought that was a great comment. The title of the book is The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song. It's published by Riverhead Books. Ben Yagoda, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song. The book is published by Riverhead. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young.